Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Keith Krueger, one of the hosts on the Intellectual History Channel. And today, it's a real honor to be joined once again by Michael Walzer, Professor Emeritus of Social Science from 1980 to 2007 at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton. A professor at both Princeton and Harvard, and for more than 30 years, he served as co-editor of Dissent, and for nearly as long as a contributing editor for The New Republic. As a professor, author, editor, and lecturer, Michael Walzer needs no introduction as one of America's foremost political thinkers, addressing a broad range of topics in political theory and moral philosophy. His empathetic and thoughtful approach allowed for the kind of interdisciplinary cross-pollination that the Institute fosters, interacting with notable scholars such as anthropologist Clifford Geertz, the political economist A.O. Hirschman, the philosopher Stuart Hampshire, and the libertarian political theorist Robert Nozick, with whom he co-taught a course titled Capitalism and Socialism. A former student, the Washington Post columnist, Brookings Senior Fellow, and policy professor E.J. Dionne once said, it was one of the best courses he ever took, adding, it was Michael Walzer who very much shaped my view. A short list of Professor Walzer's book titles include Just and Unjust Wars, Spheres of Justice, A Defense of Pluralism and Equality, The Company of Critics, Thick and Thin, Moral Argument at Home and Abroad, On Toleration, Politics and Passion, The Jewish Political Tradition, The Paradox of Liberation, Secular Revolutions and Religious Counter-Revolutions, A Foreign Policy for the Left, as well as a published conversation with the political theorist Astrid von Bousekiest, titled Justice is Steady Work, a conversation on political theory, published by Polity Press in 2020. His articles and interviews have appeared frequently in the world's foremost newspapers and journals, and when we last spoke, the focus was primarily on his 2018 A Foreign Policy for the Left. But today, we want to turn our attention primarily to his latest, The Struggle for a Decent Politics, On Liberal as an Adjective, published last month by Yale University Press. Professor Walzer, Michael, appreciate you taking the time to talk with us again. Let me start with the dedication of the latest book, where you wrote, for JBW, with whom I have been sheltering in places for more than 60 years. I bring this up in part because you mentioned recently you were moving away from Princeton after some 40 years. That's a lot of sheltering in one place. It's also an apt term, especially during the pandemic, and moving, as everyone knows, involves a bit of stress, no matter how smooth the transition. How did you both decide on the move then, and how's it going?
We aren't settled in yet. We are still in the process of trying to sell our house and get rid of thousands of books that won't fit into our New York apartment and deal with all the papers accumulated in many, many, many years of shared academic life. We're moving because our children and our grandchildren all live in the city. And it's time at our age, we're both 87, it's time for us to be close to them.
Sure it is. Since we started down this more personal path, let me ask you this now. You have a chapter on liberal feminists, and in it you describe your sheltering partner as a Bolshevik feminist. It's an enduring and humorous description, given the book's approach, but more so because, as you point out, at the time, you two were younger, and there were still many vestiges of a more chivalrous era.
Well, I call her a Bolshevik feminist because way back in the 1950s, when we were, as they say, dating, she would never let me hold a door open for her or help her on with her coat or pay for a movie ticket. She was already quite adamant on the equality of men and women. But actually, the inspiration for that chapter, the insistence that I write that chapter, came from my sister. And that chapter has been read and reread and commented on by every one of my female relatives, I think most importantly by my granddaughter. It was for an elderly man to write about issues of feminism today, well, it's a minefield, and I needed a lot of help.
Thanks for sharing that, Michael. I'm sure the source of your inspiration goes without saying among family, friends, and colleagues. Clearly, though, your writing has international appeal. Your conversation with political theorist Astrid von Busekist at Sciences Po in Paris was originally published in French, and the English version came out in 2020 as Justice's Steady Work, a conversation on political theory. In the introduction, Professor Busekist wrote, "A good political philosopher is a person who belongs in the world, or more precisely, in their world, a world of their fellows. In that sense, they do an inside job. Social critique, to be relevant, and to be connected, as Walzer says, must be performed from the inside out. Its object is one's own society. It is made stronger by its ties to the history of shared meanings, the way it exists here and now." The social critic must always be able to assume the standpoint from which they speak. This point is key to understanding Michael Walzer's work. It gives intelligibility to his research, clarifies his contribution to public debates, and characterizes the man. Astrid's reference to the relevance of social commentary as an inside job on one's own culture requires, as she wrote, the critic to be able to assume the standpoint from which they speak. Can you build on her point that this is key to understanding you and your work over the years?
It's a lovely description, and I really hope I have at least sometimes lived up to it. I've never believed that the social critic or the public intellectual should be somebody who stands on a mountaintop and wags his finger at the people down below. A social critic is a member of the society that he criticizes. And presumably he is committed, he should be committed to the well-being of that society. And so his criticism has to be addressed to his fellow citizens, and it has to be expressed in a language that's familiar to them. He is calling upon his fellow citizens to live up to their own highest aspirations and deepest values. And all my books, even those that look like political theory, all of them are political arguments addressed to my own contemporaries, and I hope always in a language that is accessible and meaningful to them.
Well put, Michael. The struggle for a decent politics on liberal as an adjective. In your preface, you point out this book is not a book about or an explication of political theory. Rather, this is an informal argument based on a lifetime of reading. I want to return to the preface, but for now, it seems important to point out how the organization of the book serves as a preview for your thoughts and considerations under particular labels. Your first chapter explains the underlying premise at work, appropriately titled Why the Adjective. The book then organizes the adjective-noun pairings, starting with chapter 2, Liberal Democrats, Liberal Socialists, chapter 3, followed by Liberal Nationalists and Internationalists, the fourth chapter, Liberal Communitarians, the fifth chapter, Liberal Feminists, chapter 6, and chapter 7 is titled Liberal Professors and Intellectuals. Chapter 8 is Liberal Jews, ending with your ninth and last chapter, Who Is and Who Isn't. In the first chapter, Why the Adjective, you point out the struggle for a decent politics is an attempt to answer the question, what does liberal morality have to do with politics? This is a context-setting chapter, I think. Listeners will be interested in hearing about, not only because of what the adjective accomplishes, but also in the way you articulate the liberal sensibility. How do you characterize this sensibility as well as its illiberal counterpart?
The argument of the book is precisely that that liberal signifies a certain morality, a certain psychology, a certain, as you say, sensibility. This is not a book about liberalism, which I don't believe right now is a coherent ideology. So I am interested in what the adjective does to all the nouns that you just listed. And I think if I were to characterize the sensibility, it is my favorite actress, Lauren Bacall, once said, a liberal is someone who doesn't have a small mind. So the adjective liberal signifies a certain generosity, of a certain sense of tolerance for ambiguity, a certain willingness to join arguments that you don't absolutely have to win, a certain acceptance of different ideologies, different religions, different kinds of human beings. And an illiberal sensibility, exemplified today all over the world, is one precisely that rejects, is intolerant of ambiguity, rejects the civil rights, the human rights of the others, whoever the others are, rejects the constraints of human rights, as in Orban's notion of an illiberal democracy, which is precisely a majoritarian rule, unconstrained by any acceptance of the civil liberties or the human rights of minorities. Liberal is supposed to do a certain kind of work. It doesn't provide the deep commitment. The deep commitment is to democracy or socialism or nationalism or community or the profession of teaching or Judaism. But that deep commitment is qualified by the adjective liberal, which imposes a certain kind of magnanimity and pluralism on the deeper commitment.
Thanks, Michael. Well, stepping back for a moment to the preface, you point out this book is about, and I quote, the best kind of politics, not a program, more a hope, described and defended in a way inspired by two books. Which books are they, and why are they significant here?
They were very important to me, both because they reflect upon my own deepest commitments. One book is by the Italian anti-fascist intellectual from the 1920s and 30s, Carlo Rosselli. He was the leader of the major non-communist resistance to Mussolini, imprisoned by Mussolini, escaped to Paris, where he continued anti-fascist activity. He was assassinated in 1937, murdered by two thugs sent to France by Mussolini. 2 years before that, he published a book called Liberal Socialism, which is an account of a kind of social democracy as an alternative to the communist resistance to Italian fascism. And the other book is by a friend of mine in Israel, Yael Tamir, who wrote a doctoral dissertation with Isaiah Berlin, the quintessential liberal, at Oxford years ago, and that was published as a book called Liberal Nationalism. And Tamir writes generally about what liberal nationalism means, but she is also expressing her own liberal Zionism. And those two books by people I greatly admire were very influential in getting me started thinking about what is the adjective doing in phrases like liberal socialism or liberal nationalism. What is the work of the adjective? And the book is really an effort to figure that out.
That's some good background. Your description of your latest book, More a Hope, reminded me of a collection of essays that the late Richard Rorty published under the title Philosophy and Social Hope. In his introduction, he pushes back on the charge of relativism and reframes his own adherence to John Dewey. So Rorty argues that both history and biology are at odds with Kant's view of human beings, and that both subjects teach us that the development of societies ruled by laws rather than men was, in his words, a slow, late, fragile, contingent, evolutionary achievement. Rorty then points out that recently Michael Walzer, a political philosopher best known for his earlier work, Spheres of Justice, has come to Hegel's and Dewey's defense. In his more recent book, Thick and Thin, Walzer argues we should not think of the customs and institutions of particular societies as accidental accretions around a common core of universal moral rationality, the transcultural moral law. Rather, we should think of the thick set of customs and institutions as prior and as what commands moral allegiance. Does your earlier work that Rorty was referring to connect or dovetail with your moral sensibility over the struggle for a decent politics? To what extent would you say being a liberal Jew informs your political theorizing and moral critiques apart from your positions on Israel?
I was a good friend of Rorty during his years in Princeton. We often met and talked together, and I am certainly influenced by his own pragmatism. Though I think I have not been much influenced by Hegel, even if I have sometimes been influenced by followers of Hegel, like perhaps Rorty thought himself to be. I do believe in the thick moral culture of a particular people does precede universal morality. Universal morality is a kind of what Rawls calls the overlapping consensus. When people who have lived a culture find themselves required to interact with other cultures, with people traveling, buying and selling, fleeing, wherever, when they feel themselves compelled to interact, that is when we get the development of the expression of a common, a universal morality that has to cross all the boundaries. So, yes, I do believe, as you said, that thick morality precedes the universal morality. But like Rorty, I'm not a relativist. I do think the universal morality has power over all of us. Now, the experience of growing up as a Jew in New York during World War II, that has certainly been a definitive experience for me, and it is expressed at many points in the new book, in all my books. World War II for a Jewish kid in New York was so obviously a just war, the war against Nazism, a necessary war. It constituted a kind of immunization against pacifism. And the experience of living in a democratic society as a minority alongside anti-Semites, but also alongside people genuinely committed to human rights, the human rights of everyone. That experience has been very, very important in shaping my own attitudes toward minorities, toward the meaning of democratic politics, the meaning of citizenship. All of that has been very much shaped by my experience as an American Jew. And a number of my critics, some of my biographers, have recognized that at every point in my work.
Well, in that piece, Rorty also wrote that someone who adopts the anti-Kantian stance common to Hegel, Dewey, and Walzer is asked to defend the thick morality of the society with which she identifies herself and will not be able to do so by talking about the rationality of her moral views. Do you agree with Rorty on this and being grouped with Hegel and Dewey as anti-Kantians? Pretty heady company, however you put it.
Yes, a comic series. I don't belong in it. I hold and have defended the views attributed to me by Rorty, but I don't come to them through the work of Hegel and Dewey. I don't think of myself as a philosopher, at least not in any professional sense. And I think most philosophers don't think of me as a philosopher. But I do hold those views, and I've come upon them in my own fashion through my own experience. Yes, I. You know, there is a Jewish joke, a guy about a son who comes to visit his parents, and he's dressed like a sailor or a yachtsman, because he's just bought a yacht, and this is his uniform. And his mother looks at him and says, "So you're a captain by your father, you're a captain. By me, you're a captain. But by the captains, are you a captain?" So I think if you consult the philosophers, they will tell you that I don't belong in the company of Hegel and Dewey.
I'm not sure everyone would agree with that assessment, but let's move on to your second chapter, which covers liberal Democrats. That's the title. You open describing the process of progressive inclusion as working out of democracy itself, and point out, as with freedom, eternal struggle is the price of democracy. You go on to note that racism, followed by the inequalities of class and gender, are America's particular pathologies. And you note, historically, democracy has been very undemocratic. I want to start with your focus on the question, who makes up the majority? That is, who are counted as the people? Can you talk about your thinking, with regard to the demos and the agents of democratization in the U.S.?
Well, the demos should include all of the citizens of the society, and any immigrants should be on the road to citizenship. So I believe that democracy implies a radical inclusiveness. Government by the governed means all of the governed. It means that no one experiences government as a tyrannical force from the outside. Now, that's not a description of any of the regimes that we call democratic, beginning with ancient Athens. So the history of democracy is a history of the the storming of the citadel of citizenship by all of the outsiders, the slaves, the proletarians, women, Jews, blacks, all new immigrants. It's a long story of a whole series of people, groups of people, demanding inclusion, demanding equal citizenship. And that is democratic history. Many of the battles that have been fought and won, the victories have turned out to be partial and incomplete, and the battles have to be fought again, as in Reconstruction after the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement and Black Lives Matter. It's an ongoing struggle, and the same thing can be said about class and gender. It's not that all the victories are temporary. Some of them seem to be sustained, but they continue. They are incomplete, and the battles continue. And democratic politics, in my view, left politics, is simply the story of the demand for equality.
Thanks, Michael. Can you share also with listeners your explanation of populism and your use of the term maximal leader in that chapter? You write about the typology of reward, repression, and constitution rigging, as well as the treatment of journalists and organized opposition. Seems important and relevant these days. And how do you attribute the attraction, as you mentioned just now, Hungary's Viktor Orban, the illiberal Democrat, to summon the Republican Party?
Well, first, we need a definition of populism, and it is a kind of majoritarian rule without any constraints. This unrestrained majority tends to find a personal representative, and he is the maximal leader. The phrase comes from Latin American populism, but you can also think of Nazism. The maximal leader claims to embody the general will. He claims to represent the people with a capital P. And he claims the right to suppress opposition in the name of democracy, majoritarian democracy. We see that in a country like Hungary. We see tendencies toward that in Poland and very recently in Israel. Trumpism is a tendency. It's not the same thing, but it is a tendency in that direction. With Trump doing a good imitation of a maximal leader, I alone can save you, and that is a politics that has to be described as it is a democratic version, ultra democratic majoritarian version of the end of democracy, because democracy, the rule of the governed, requires the ability of the governed to criticize the government and to organize political parties and social movements for a purpose, even the purpose of changing the government. So this is a version of democracy that is the end of democracy. Why it has appeal? I think that has a lot to do with, in the United States, a lot to do with the sharp increase in inequality in the United States over the last decades. The sense of many, many Americans, workers, victims of globalization, of industrial decline, the sense of many Americans that they have been left behind, that the quote unquote elites don't care about them, are actually working to replace them as the effective citizens of this country. I think inequality has a lot to do with it, and ideological racism, white nationalism. I don't want to say it's entirely the product of economic inequality, but I think that is an important part of it. And I think the abandonment of social democratic and American liberal politicians, the abandonment of the old working class, is one of the causes of Trumpism. I can tell a story, my own story of two cities, I grew up in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which was in the 40s and 50s and 60s, a steel town, Bethlehem Steel. And it was, after the Union came in 41, it was a Democratic town. And then the steel industry disappeared. The Union collapsed. The Democratic Congress people could not do anything to rescue the city. And in 2016, Johnstown voted 2-1 for Trump, an old Democratic city, 2-1 for Trump. I now live in Princeton, New Jersey, one of the richer towns in the United States, which voted 6-1 for Hillary Clinton. So the Democratic Party abandoned the workers of Johnstown, decided to depend on the educated professional middle class in places like Princeton, and contributed, I think, to its own political disaster. And Joe Biden represents an effort to recommit the Democratic Party to the working people of America. That was the meaning of Build Back Better. It has a only partial success, given the state of Congress, where the Democrats either don't have a majority or have a terribly, terribly slim majority. Anyway, that's the, in my view of, I think my Tale of Two Cities tells a sociological and political story.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And it's interesting too that Phil Gramm was recently on C-SPAN talking about his book with a couple of economists, and the title of the book was called The Myth of Inequality Propaganda. I think it seems like we've got these conflicting narratives that go on. Your third chapter, Liberal Socialists, opens by pointing out that the word liberal is indeed a strong adjective, constraining not only populists who hold office, but also the leftist politicians when in power. You bring up FDR's 1937 court packing scheme as a kind of lightweight illiberal machination relative to his decision to forcibly intern Japanese Americans in California during World War II. The Civil Liberties Act that President Reagan signed into law in 1988 issued a formal apology and gave surviving members, Japanese members, of course, $20,000 each 40 years after the internment camps were closed. John Tashishi, who was in the camp as a small child, has written two books in the last few years. One is about life in the camps, and another is about the campaign for reparations. In an NPR interview in 2020, he was asked about reparations for slavery to Black Americans and said this: "I know that this kind of thing is never just about money, because money often doesn't resolve the problem. It goes much deeper than that. It's the whole issue of racism in America. Until there are efforts made to try to resolve the root causes and to get at the racism, it's going to be a tough battle to move forward. I have no idea how to resolve something so profound, but we have to try. It can't just stagnate there and fester like a wound." Ta-Nehisi Coates has made the case in The Atlantic, and Thomas Piketty, in his latest book, The Future of Equality, devoted an entire chapter to the question of reparations, writing, "No matter how complex this question is, it cannot be evaded forever. It is time to act unless we want deep and lasting injustice to continue." The subject of reparations seems a non-starter on a number of levels, but there is a precedent for redress. And historically, even former slave owners have been compensated for their loss of property. Human property, I should say. I realize there are no easy answers here, but your counsel on this matter, Professor, informed over a lifetime, both religious and secular, as well as a keen sense of political systems. How do you think about the question of reparations?
Well, there are now in several American cities movements to organize some kind of reparations for Black Americans. They are, I think, politically quite remarkable, because I would have thought that this was a non-starter in American politics. I mean personal reparations, gifts of money to particular people from the tax base. If I were in these cities, I think I'd probably be part of these movements. Nationally, I really believe that overcoming racism is a question that has to be dealt with at the level of employment and housing, very critically in ways that shape the social structure within which Black people and white people live today. I think the most effective reparations and the ones that might be actually politically possible are reparations that transform the character of inner city schools, that transfer the way Americans are housed, that transform the job market. Those kinds of efforts, I think, would really be reparative. That is to say, they would repair the conditions of the reality of racism in the United States. And those kinds of measures, it seems to me, are politically possible, whereas I would like to believe differently, but I don't think on a national level, a politician advocating personal reparations, gifts of money to particular people, would command much of a following. But the attack on structural racism, that is a possible politics.
Yeah, no, I think you're right about that. And you mentioned that constitutional limits and the fact that these limits are questioned legally and politically, these disputes are settled over time by, as you say, complex processes, which make it difficult to overturn any existing rights or liberties. I want to use your observation there for connecting points you make in other chapters. So I want to segue from chapter 2, Liberal Democrats, to one of your opening points in chapter 7, Liberal Professors and Intellectuals, where you bring up the struggles of professors struggling at multiple campuses without security or tenure. I bring this up in part because of the irony you note regarding the importance of educating citizens in a democracy, and also because I recently spoke with just such an adjunct. He has noted, among other challenges, that it took him about 10 years to write his first book. I'm referring to Professor Robert Ovitz, who splits his teaching time between the California State and UC systems, and just published his third book, We the Elite, Why the U.S. Constitution Serves the Few. In it, he argues it is so hard to initiate change on important issues in the United States, not only because minority interests have historically stymied proposed legislation, but also to what amounts to a federal constitution that is effectively not amendable, noting it has been changed on just 27 times over 230 years, and not a single change in the last 30 years, including the Equal Rights Amendment for women, which is still not ratified. I don't expect you to have read his book, but the title gives one a good idea about the thesis, which shares some overlap with the work of historians like Charles Beard in terms of challenging the American creed and the founder's aura and intent. It's the intersection of interest, though, that I thought you might be keen to comment on in broader terms, because you have some interesting observations on the Trump nationalists of 2020, linked by a class history and a populist politics, as you put it in Chapter 4, Liberal Nationalists and Internationalists.
Yes. Again, a large question, and I should begin by saying we have indeed created an academic proletariat, and not to the benefit of either the young graduate students and young professors or people wanting to be professors, and also not to the benefit of their students. This is a typical American struggle, so that we now have unionization movements on many, many campuses, recently successful at University of California and its branches. And unionization is the right way to struggle against proletarianization. So this is an American story, and one that I hope will bring new activism and new participatory politics to our campuses. I certainly agree. The Constitution makes political struggle very difficult for the left and much, much easier for the right. That's the character of the Constitution. You could argue that that's what it was intended. Some of the amendments have helped a little bit, but still, that is the Constitution we have. And political struggles right now, your author is right to say the Constitution is not amendable. So political struggles right now have to be fought within the structure that we have. And there is some evidence that we can win partial victories. The civil rights movement was a partial victory. The movement for gay rights has been a partial victory. Feminism has had significant victories within this Constitution that poses only obstacles for victories of this sort, and yet there have been victories. What is the great dilemma, the great problem for the American left, is that the victories for Black people, the partial, incomplete victories for Black people, for gay people, for women, have been accompanied by rising inequality. So you have egalitarian successes in a society that has become more unequal. And that has to be the subject of left speculation and left activism. How did that happen? What is the connection between the partial victories and the growing inequality? I think that is, for the left right now, the central political question.
Thanks for that. That's important. Your chapter, Liberal Communitarians, is important because of what it means for a participatory democracy, among other things. And you start with an explanation of communitarianism as, and I quote, the close connection of a group of people who share a strong commitment to a religion, culture, or a politics. Their goal is a promotion of the quality of their communal life. Can you give listeners a feel for the focus of your discussion of communitarianism and the tension it presents for your more pluralistic approach to the liberal community?
Yes, I have been called a communitarian, and I wanted to stress that I am, if I am a communitarian, I am very much a liberal communitarian. And the best way of explaining that is to describe two versions of communitarianism. And one of them is the civil republic, as described by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, in which the citizens are endlessly active. They do everything for themselves. Rousseau believed that there shouldn't be a professional army, there shouldn't be professional politicians, there shouldn't be professional teachers, and certainly not professional police. All of these activities should be the activities of citizens working in various ways of rotation and shared participation. It is a picture that seems to me to be exhausting and too warm. I am not a civil Republican. I believe in a liberal democratic framework within which there can be many communities. That is, a liberal framework is one that makes possible the intense communal ties that people form of different sorts, religious and ethnic and professional and political. There has to be room for many communities, and that's the kind of communitarian I am. I believe in the value of close, intense relations of the sort that I don't always have, but believe I should have with fellow academics or fellow socialists or fellow Jews. I think citizenship has to be a somewhat cooler relationship, a little more distanced, where there is room for representative democracy rather than direct democracy, where there is room for professional teachers rather than elderly citizens, as Rousseau suggests, taking over the classroom, and where there is room for professional police, much, much better than what we have, but professional, rather than having the citizens police each other. Through neighborhood committees of the sort that have sometimes been described in abolitionist literature. So that's what I mean by liberal communitarian. Let there be many communities, and let there be a framework which allows the particular intensities of each one of them.
Well, your book has so much to draw on, and the narrative itself, I think, lends itself to any kind of really a multiple levels of classroom use, I think. People who have added spark, and I say that because I feel that's you, do not usually go unnoticed or unappreciated in a liberal democratic republic. Partisanship usually stops at the line of national interests, as well it should. Consider this. President Biden has asked you to lead a presidential commission on reframing our nation's purpose, values, history, and meaning, and in effect, the mission impossible. His aides have confided to you that this is really about formulating policy to come to terms with America's current polarization. Given recent history and campaigns for social change, you find yourself in this scenario determined to avoid what seems to be the longer term in...
Yes, the ineffectiveness of those groups. If I were a member of such a commission, I'm not sure governments or countries have a national purpose like a political party does or a social movement. The national purpose of the American state should be to sustain, to realize, and then sustain the democracy that and the equality that was the promise of our founding. And I believe that requires perennial struggle. And I think that groups like Black Lives Matter are an essential part of that struggle. Often activists in those parties drift toward a kind of absolutist or sectarian politics, which is ineffective in American history. But that doesn't mean that we don't need groups like that, and we don't need groups like that to have internal dissidents who resist absolutism and who work to create social movements that can draw broad support. Those are the social movements that I hope to join, support, and that I hope will always be qualified by the adjective liberal.
Well put, Michael. A nice way to close. Those interested in broadening both their understanding of politics and political theory, and the crucial distinction between what liberal and or illiberal mean as adjectives, from the perspective of a life lived steeped in the actual politics then and now, would do well to pick up Michael Walzer's The Struggle for a Decent Politics on liberal as an adjective, published in 2023 by Yale University Press. Let me also call attention to the Blackstone audiobook, professionally read by Robert Fass, who really brings Michael's far-ranging political thoughts and narrative to life. Michael Walzer, political theorist, pluralist, and guiding light to so many, appreciate you making the time for this.
Okay, thanks for doing this.